We're still in this space of what I view as turf warfare. Banks don't want to get cut out. They don't want to lose their fees. They don't want to lose out in deposits. The government doesn't want to lose out on its ability to tax, right, and to have their piece. And central banks don't want to lose out on their position in the money game.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Matt Allen, and this week I am joined by Catherine Wichker, Max Waddington, Dom Breslin, and very special guest from Cubic Labs, Ian Kane. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hey, everyone.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
If you wanted to kick us off, I think it would be great just give our listeners an overview of yourself, what you do at Cubic Labs, and what you're excited about.
Okay, great. How long do you have? My name's Ian Kane. I'm a co-founder and executive chair of Cubic Labs. We are an innovation hub based in Quincy, Massachusetts. By way of background, I come from, I guess, private equity and venture capital across a number of spaces, including energy, tech, telecom. And I spent 10 years as a city councilor in Quincy as well. And if you knew anything about Quincy, which, you know, abuts Boston at its southern border, we've been going through our own renaissance of sorts. And there's been a lot of real estate development, mostly large complexes. And at a certain point in time, I wanted to see some of that activity complemented with startup and innovation activity so that we could be a place that people could live, work, and play as opposed to just sort of commute into town. So we had an opportunity to partner with a local real estate developer called Fox Rock Properties, and they had some dormant space that they made available to us and said, if you know you can do something with it, please do. They gave us 14,000 square feet of office space, and you know, we had very little money, but we scrounged together some furniture from wherever we could, and we put together a plan to support the growth of an ecosystem around fintechs and govtech companies and startups. And before long, so this is 2019, and 2020, blockchain found us through a state program. So in my public hat, the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative was running an education program for local electeds on blockchain deployments in cities and towns. Now, I had been familiar with distributed ledger technology. I was not a crypto person or a Bitcoin maxi by any means, but through that session, I quickly recognized that we could differentiate ourselves by supporting this space because nobody had really built a startup hub for the region. Of course, there were institutions like yours that were, you know, looking into the space. I knew the Matt Walshes of the world from grad school who had started Cast Lion and come out of your space as well. But there was no real startup space dedicated to blockchain and digital asset companies. So we kind of moved forward with this value proposition that we would build that. So over 7 years, you know, we built, three pillars to our organization. From 21 to 22, you know, we started, you know, with a loose incubator model, but then we put together a $5 million public-private partnership with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, who gave us a sizable grant. We matched that dollar for dollar with private sector capital and in-kind contributions to create an R&D innovation program. So what that enabled us to do is distributed non-dilutive grants to founders who were building blockchain projects. And, you know, really you just had to be working on a blockchain project. And, you know, we would help them through proof of concept and minimum viable product. And then we'd help them to raise capital on the back end. The second component of Cubic that, you know, we were enabled to build was an accelerator program. So evolving from this sort of loose incubator program where people either took space or we worked with people on an infrequent basis to a 12-week accelerator program that we've done two cohorts. In fact, the first demo day after our cohort one at the beginning of 25, we hosted at Summer Street at Fidelity. You guys were kind to host us for that. And then we in 2022 took over what was a dormant event called Boston Blockchain Week. And, you know, I think as you all very well know, during that time, 2021, 22, there was a lot of energy moving from the Northeast to Miami and Austin and, you know, even New York, San Francisco, wherever, but they were leaving Massachusetts and the vibe wasn't here. And we had an opportunity to take the event, and it not only helped us to tell a story about the ecosystem that we wanted to build and to support, but we really wanted to take some of that energy that was in other places that we experienced and plant it here and let it grow and thrive.
That's really exciting. And we really love to hear that. You know, I think the Boston Blockchain Week is a great event. So really awesome that you've put so much time and effort into taking that over and making it such a great event. Now, I'm really curious. You've been kind of grassroots right in the thick of the industry for about 7 years now. What has changed? What's exciting to you now? What are you seeing that you think is really great in the area?
We've seen a lot of change. You've seen up and down cycles, right? Which I think supports the level of excitement and exuberance that exists in the space. I always, you know, coming as a sort of non-dogmatist to the space, I've looked at this very interestingly and sort of looking at it from the public and private sector side, I have a unique perspective as well. I think that, you know, we're still in this space of what I view as turf warfare. You know, and I think that if you go back to the fundamental philosophy of decentralization and what it was meant to be, you know, you had groups that were trying to disintermediate banks and other institutions that were, you know, I guess ostensibly getting in the way of individuals and organizations transacting. But those organizations and institutions don't want to be disintermediated, right? Banks don't want to get cut out. They don't want to lose their fees. They don't want to lose out in deposits. The government doesn't want to lose out on its ability to tax, right? And to have their piece. And central banks don't want to lose out on their position in the money game. And so, you know, for a long time, we were just kind of standing back and watching like, what's going on here? Because you've got the Bitcoin people, the crypto people, and then all these other entities who are sort of vying and jockeying for positions within this new realm and ecosystem. So I think that you've seen people in their approach and their philosophy to the space change a lot. So what once was pure decentralization, you know, we're cutting out the middlemen here, we're now seeing much more gravitation towards the institutional place, right? And there's positives and there's negatives to all of that. But, you know, we've just seen the space sort of change its tune because I think it was a lot more freewheeling when we came into it in 2019, 2020 than it is today, where it's, you know, taking this institutional bent. And I think as the institutional bent continues to take hold, we've also continued to see this conversation around regulation take place. I mean, that's been the only thing that people have talked about for the 7 years that we've been in this space. And so, you know, that's an important component of it. But again, it sort of flies in the face of what the space was originally meant to be.
In terms of what the space was originally meant to be, could you tell us a little bit about what you see as the evolution of the projects that people are coming up with in your incubator? Like, what were they coming up with? What are they coming up with now? If we're seeing this trend in the change of view, maybe it'd be great to hear kind of how that's manifesting in this really grassroots organization that you have.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine. That's a great question. Now, in 7 years, we've worked with over 70 different types of startups. We've helped raise over $40 million. They've created hundreds of jobs. As an economic development organization, Cubic Labs is a nonprofit. We've got great top line numbers. You know, when we're first starting off as a new game in town, we had to really figure out how to prove value to startups and to founders. And I think, you know, we were not less discerning, but we wanted to get people in the door. And so, you know, the conversations that you had with people who wanted to float a coin to support a real estate portfolio that they really didn't have access to, you know, and knew nothing about securities law and knew, you know what I mean? And had no idea how to interpret the landscape that they were trying to jump into has certainly evolved. Now we have people who are developing more institutionally ready and compliant orchestration layers for multi-asset portfolio management. And, you know, I know we're going to get into discussion on sort of the muni side, but we've got, you know, a startup that's working on a municipal bond platform specifically. And we've got folks that are working on institutionally, you know, ready products that can support foreign exchange and remittance payments. So it's certainly a sophistication because you saw a lot of younger people who, when, I mean, money was flying around everywhere. So you had all these blockchain protocols who were minting coins and you know, they were just printing money and giving it out to anyone because they wanted to build ecosystem. But now what you're seeing is people who've had experience in their relative or related sectors, whether financial services or a specific industry, that have that experience and can understand how it can be innovated. And so that is certainly a valuable component of this.
That's super interesting, Ian. And it kind of tees up the next question I had for you. I know you've talked about it a little bit, so maybe you could teach our audience a little bit about this like digital infrastructure stack. Where do you see the biggest constraints in that today?
Thanks. Yeah. So we've been using this term, the digital infrastructure stack, for a few years, because once we started to execute on the R&D program, we started to think more broadly about how as an organization we can support the public and the private sector, because they both play hand in hand. And in most of these use cases, you know, especially around the bond project and others, and in financial services generally, you need the government buy-in. And so, you know, we were looking at, okay, there are all these emerging techs, blockchain, there's AI, all these projects have cybersecurity, but they all tie into the base sort of level infrastructure of cities and towns, right? So thinking from the place of electricity and water and broadband and internet capacity. I worked on a project here in Quincy in my public hat for 7 years trying to build a municipal fiber optic network to support both residents and businesses because they need bandwidth, right? So thinking about how these emerging techs fit into that stack and how are cities and towns prepared to enable residents to participate in the digital economy that is here and that is burgeoning? But how are they enabling businesses to operate from those locations and to be competitive in the digital economy, right? Because as you're seeing right now play out, you've got a new political football. You've had a political football going on in energy, but now you have a political football coupled with AI and data centers. Right now, we can argue for another call on sort of the realities of that conversation. But, you know, cities and towns are now at the, I guess, whim of their residents in most cases and the fears that are playing out, which are preventing some competitive marketplaces from forming. And I think we're actually seeing this, you know, in Massachusetts. So, you know, the digital infrastructure stack, it's important. And cities and towns, again, they're woefully unprepared. They're not looking at it as this huge stack, including the emerging tech. And so we want to position ourselves as being the clearinghouse, for lack of a better term, of technologies and innovations that can support, you know, this placement and this competition.
I think that transitions really nicely into something that we want to talk about, which is this Quincy Municipal Bond. Maybe that would be a good jumping off point to kind of give listeners like the context of what you're speaking about here and how exciting it can be.
Sure. Yeah, this was, you know, interestingly, in that original education series that was led by the state program, this was a use case that came up and sort of we kept it in the back of our mind. And I think it was in 2022, I'd read about Lugano, Switzerland floating the first municipal bond in the world. And so, you know, we were fortunate in Quincy to have good relationships and, you know, we had a young CFO at the time who was innovative and we had a supportive mayor. You need to understand that the government needs incentive to do this, right? So on a municipal bond offering, why would a municipality want to change the way that they've done things? Or why would anybody or government want to change the way they do things? In this case, there's an opportunity to make an appeal to the public, right? To actually include the public in the financing of infrastructure and other projects that they can participate not only in a civic way, but enjoy some financial upside. And so the mayor of Quincy enjoyed that. The mayor of Quincy said, you know, this is kind of cool. I could say I'm offering Quincy bonds for Quincy people, and any city or town could say that. And imagine the ability for an individual that lives in Boston or Quincy or wherever you live, being able to participate at a low dollar amount in a municipal bond offering that then your, you know, coupon payment could go towards fees within the system, right? Whether it's tax or some sort of, you know, your water bill, but it keeps that money in the economy, right? So it keeps circulating. So there's a really interesting use case. So that's the incentive, is that this is a really innovative offering to align civic and financial participation at the local level. Then you have to look at, can we do this? So from soup to nuts, it was about 18-month process. And it first started off with a feasibility study, you know, trying to understand, unpack the entire municipal bond process from the issuer side, looking at all of the stakeholders, and the fee structure is pretty dense. So, you know, you've got financial advisor, you've got underwriters, you've got bond counsel, you've got this counsel, you've got, you know, there's 8 to 10 layers of this thing. And so understanding how to basically recreate that within a blockchain environment. So, you know, we took some time to talk to, you name it. You know, I've got a case study that I'm happy to share with everyone and how that process went down, but we understood what's possible. And the options were, you know, you spend a considerable amount of time and investment to build your own platform to make what I described happen, which is enabling that individual. And of course, including any, you know, regulatory hurdles that may be and legal hurdles, or you go with something that's on the shelf. And so the on the shelf in this case ended up being an interested party in a relationship that the city had with JP Morgan. And so JP Morgan at the time, you know, had been developing their Onyx platform, which they now call Kinexys, and they showed an interest. And sort of that's how that conversation took hold. The organization that managed this transaction is called Blockwise Advisors. Now, Blockwise Advisors is an affiliate of Cubic. So personally, I had no involvement in this transaction, but of course I, you know, had an understanding and learning along the way. But the, you know, the, as the saying goes, you can't go wrong with choosing IBM. And I think that was sort of the way that, you know, this was the way to go. It was a household name. They had an idea of what they were going to do and how to execute. It was presented appropriately. And the city in the end decided to do it. Now, it was very interesting because this was a first of a kind transaction. You know, there were fits and starts to this process at a certain point in time. But again, we were fortunate to have a municipality that was willing and interested and a technology that was ready and able to execute.
That's awesome and fascinating to see that development and that use case. Have you kind of seen it tie back to the city of Quincy and the residents there in the way that you were describing in the beginning, where you can kind of tie the returns on your coupon to paying some of your fees? Have you started to see that infrastructure begin to build?
Not yet. Yeah, not yet. That's a long-term goal. And I think, you know, like one of the companies that we support who will be at Boston Blockchain Week next week, ZuzLab, is working to enable that type of transaction. You know, what ended up happening in this one, it was a $10 million offering for roadway work, and JP Morgan ended up purchasing that slug outright. And what then happened, actually, BlackRock bought 65% of that debt on the secondary market. So it proved, you know, another component, I guess, of the continuum of that security. So we haven't seen the ground level yet. That, you know, I love that use case. And I think that as we're talking about infrastructure, all of these things, they take so long to make happen. I think, you know, large financial institutions like yours, and whether it's a municipal government or the federal government, take a long time to develop these interconnections. And you have to have an iron stomach, you know, to do things like that, and a long-term vision and commitment for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does. It, and I imagine that there's a whole nother set of issues that you have on the other side, connecting locals to this digital infrastructure in that way, right? To finish that loop is a whole nother set of issues that have to develop. I am very interested personally in following your work and seeing what happens in Quincy.
Thank you. Yeah, I think important to note on that, and I think you see this in a lot of use cases, not just this, is that one of the main issues is liquidity. You're not going to put out a $10 million offering to the city of Quincy to do roadway work and expect it to be fully subscribed, right? I think that the goal would be to have a bifurcated sale or a certain component carved out for residential participation. You know what I mean? So that you're not, you still need the liquidity of the capital markets to fulfill the finance needs. And I think that in a broader perspective, in the greater adoption of blockchain for, in this case, municipal bonds, it's still about liquidity. There's not enough money on chain to fulfill the requirements of the marketplace.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the liquidity component is something that we talk about a lot, whether it be in this instance or any other use case, but certainly a space to watch as things continue to improve year over year. And to that end, I think there is something, another interesting topic that we wanted to pick your brain on a little bit, which is the research and the work that you've been doing with FIX and trading in the blockchain basics document. Do you mind diving into that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, this is the standardized communications protocol for global trade that I knew nothing about before last October. And we had a relationship with co-chairs of the steering committee. He had been a mentor in our cohorts and he works for a broker dealer, and suggested that we could potentially get involved in helping their ecosystem to get up to speed. Now, you know, they've got 300 plus members, large and small financial institutions. But what it seems is that the trading side of the house has been cut off from the digital asset teams. And so the trading teams continue to do what they do and know what they do very well, but they're not up to speed on what's going on in the digital asset side. So, you know, what we, you know, we spent the last 8-9 months now sort of mapping out how to bridge the divide between traditional finance, in this case, you know, in the fixed community, and digital assets. And, you know, we recognize, of course, that education is important because, and in the entire space, I mean, you know, adoption is most likely going to be successful if people understand how these things work. And I think as a side note, from our perspective, from the get-go, especially trying to work down to the retail level, people, when they hear the word blockchain, are either excited or turned off because they're afraid and don't understand it. And so, you know, we still don't have that cohesive opportunity to educate people on what this entire space that's unfolding before them. But in the fixed community, we put together a blockchain basics document, basically in using fixed terminology for what the blockchain sort of looks like, right? We announced this document and started sort of promoting it at an event at State Street in June in Boston. And, you know, we were talking about, of course, some of the things that remain unresolved and some of the bigger players in the space. But, you know, you'd say a household name like a Tether, which of course everyone knows is a very large stablecoin provider. And out of a room of 150 people, two people raised their hand. So, you know, I think it's indicative to us in a number of things that there's still a long way to go in this space to make institutionally ready these interconnections, as the infrastructure, the piping, and to have the more technically minded ones and zeros people get together on the same page to make these interconnections. So, you know, in FIX, there's a great opportunity for them to take a position as they did in the 90s with electronic trading with blockchain in order to make some standards prevalent so that people are communicating on the same page, right?
And Catherine, to your point, I think you guys mentioned liquidity. I think education is that another huge pillar that connects kind of the people on the ground to what's going on, you know, and what you're helping out with, Ian. I want to call out that paper that you did with FIX as, you know, a must read to anyone in financial services, especially, but anyone in general. I thought it was really well done. Just heard about it this week. And yeah, I would just recommend people checking it out.
Another thing I'd like to just call out about what you said, Ian, is the plumbing. A lot of the way that, at least the way I see it, that digital assets and distributed ledger technology integrates with financial services today is really in the plumbing. And it's kind of the stuff that was developed, a lot of it is the stuff that was developed in the 80s and 90s. And most people have kind of forgotten how it functions for the most part or why it works the way that it does, but we just know it does work. And so when blockchain comes in and tries to fix these or solve for these latencies in that old technology, it really is requiring a lot of the market, financial services, and the crypto-minded folks to really understand what is that plumbing, which isn't always glorious, and how does blockchain fix it to create something that is glorious?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's not only how does it fix it or how is it better enabled? I mean, if you're looking at some of the, I guess, the four important aspects of the sort of fix exercise, but just more broadly, you know, there's a huge gap in scalability here between what a blockchain or what specific blockchains can handle and what the financial services industry processes, right? There's interoperability issues. There are many different blockchains that operate in different ways. They have different rules. They have, you know, and they don't talk to each other and they don't all interact in one place. So there's, again, an opportunity to be that sort of unification layer. There are, I guess, things about, you know, finality, right? And deterministic finality, right? Of the transaction itself. And then I think just overall sort of just the regulatory clarity in how these rules are evolving globally. So, you know, and those are the high level, but the intricacies in the ins and outs of the plumbing, which I don't think people think is necessarily sexy. You know, the coins and the number go up is kind of cool and the meme things. I think, you know, there's a decade's worth of work here to be done.
Just on that, Ian, then, in your opinion, then, where is the area in infrastructure that's receiving the least amount of capital or not enough attention, in your opinion? Is it just purely the trading, like you mentioned, or is there something else?
I mean, that's where we're looking. You know, that's just where we are. That's where we've happened to find ourselves right now for us in trying to maintain interest and relevance, right? It's where can we differentiate ourselves as identifying founders and startups who can help us to build. And so this is where I'm seeing the play. So I think, you know, generally, you know, as institutions are, you know, large, they're waving the flag and they're saying tokenization and all this is moving and they're interested. I see the opportunity to be that connection and the bridge and to support institutionally and regulatorily compliant startups who can help build these connections.
Speaking of building connections, maybe this is a good section to kind of highlight what's coming up with Boston Blockchain Week. If any of our listeners are in the Boston area, what are the dates? What can they maybe expect if they decide to attend?
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, so Boston Blockchain Week is taking place the 8th, 9th, and 10th of September. This is our fifth year hosting the event. Ray Allen from, you know, the FCAT team knows. She's been to our first event back in 22 and we were standing the thing up. And, you know, we're, last year, of course, we had the CEO and chair of Fidelity, Abby Johnson, come and do a sit down fireside chat, which was, we were so gracious to have her and her time. You know, this has been a labor of love. You know, as I said, this has been about building the ecosystem and the space for the greater Boston area. We have over 100 speakers coming from all different parts of the ecosystem. The theme is the digital infrastructure stack. So we're very committed to, you know, as this conversation is outlined. And we've got an opening keynote from the chief security officer of Coinbase. We have a keynote from the chief commercial officer from Circle. We have a fireside chat with the chief counsel of the crypto task force from the SEC. And, you know, a whole host of others. So please come down. It's being hosted at the Marriott Quincy Boston, 8th, 9th, and 10th. You can find more information at bostonblockchainweek.com.
Amazing. Those are some heavy hitters. It's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, come on down.
Well, listen, I know that we're right about time. So Max, Catherine, Dom, thank you so much for joining us. Ian, thank you so much for your time. This has been great to speak with you. And if anyone's interested in Cubic Labs, you know, either the mentorship program, or, you know, the accelerator looking to make those connections and build out the financial infrastructure of the future, I think they know who to reach out to at this point.
Love it. Thank you, guys. This has been fun. Thanks for having me.
Sounds like Quincy's where it's at, right, Ian?
I love that. It's where it's at.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.